Okay, our final session of the day will be a panel on, guess what, ATSC 3.0. And Jerry Whitaker has graciously agreed to serve as the panel moderator, along with giving us an update on the standards process to date. Mr. Whitaker supports the work of various ATSC technology and specialist groups and assists in the development of ATSC standards and related documents. He currently serves as Secretary of the Technology and Standards Group and Secretary of the Technology Group on Next Generation Broadcast Television. He's closely involved in work relating to educational programs. Mr. Whitaker is a Fellow of the SBE and a Fellow of SMPTE. He has served as a board member and vice president of SBE. Jerry is the author and editor of more than 35 books on technical topics and previously the editor and editorial director and associate publisher of Broadcast Engineering Magazine and Video Systems Magazine. Jerry Whitaker.
Thank you, Leonard. Well, good afternoon, everybody. We're going to wrap up the session this afternoon on ATSC 3.0 with a panel discussion featuring three of the previous speakers you've heard today. Okay, so our panel consists of Fred Baumgartner, Next Generation TV Implementation, One Media Sinclair Broadcast, Martin Horsepool from GatesAir, and Christine Zuba from Dielectric. Of course, you're familiar with all three. They had papers earlier. Jay Adrick had planned to be here today, but unfortunately was unable to attend. So I want to begin the panel discussion with a brief overview of ATSC 3.0, kind of where we are, and begin the 30,000-foot view perspective at the beginning. ATSC 1.0 has been talked about before. Of course, we now retroactively call it ATSC 1.0. It's A53, the first digital broadcast television standard that ushered in high-definition video, multicasting capabilities, digital surround sound, EPGs, extensibility, new closed captioning services. And it was revolutionary in 1995 when the first document was approved. Of course, technology has changed in the 22 years since then. We have ultra-high definition television, which has taken the market by storm. The word is from the CE industry that soon virtually all television sets that you can buy above a certain 40-ish inch the diagonal will be UHD. Of course, phones of all makes and models and sizes and configurations, laptop computers, and so forth. Also, consumer demands are changing. Fred touched on this. Over-the-air viewership is growing. Over-the-top services continue to grow very rapidly. Mobile viewing continues to increase, extraordinarily important. And the cord-cutting, shaving nevers are changing the TV landscape. And there's an interesting mixing of technologies and rivers and trends that's occurring now, and it's a good time to be in a position to do something very concrete about ATSC 3.0. Of course, on-demand viewing is an assumed feature today. Digital advertising is increasingly important and powerful, and by digital I mean web-based advertising. Targeting advertising is essential. We tried to do that in ATSC 1.0 with a PSIP, an extension to PSIP, and it's hard to do with the MPEG-2 transport stream. With an IP-based system, which is what ATSC 3.0 is, it's not simple, but it's relatively easy. It's essentially changing the pointer to what's next. Of course, consumers have become app-centric as well, and we need to deal with that. So any technology aimed at the consumers has to be driven toward what the consumers want, and consumers clearly want higher resolution images and sound. Major improvements have been made in video and audio coding over the last 20 years. And there was a discussion earlier, I think it was in Martin's presentation, about the improvement in bit rate for a given SNR. And that's an important part of the story, but it's only part of the story. The other half of that is that MPEG-2 efficiency is, what, 25% of HEVC? And AC4 audio coding can be a 2x improvement. That is to say, reduction over A52. So, you know, you put those things together, and it's quite a big improvement. Of course, spectrum is becoming increasingly scarce, and it's not just a U.S. phenomenon. It's happening all over the world. Personalization and interactivity is expected by consumers. They want content, you know, wherever, on demand, wherever they are, if they're mobile. Interestingly, though, mobile, I heard a presentation a couple of months ago, most viewing on mobile devices is actually done at home, which speaks well to Fred's gateway concept. Better audience measurement accuracy is expected by advertisers, and with an IP-based system with an assumed return channel, either continuously or at least intermittently, we can do that. We started out the work on ATSC 3.0 identifying some key use cases. Some of them are pretty obvious, some perhaps not so much. Flexible use of the spectrum is item one, and then mobile services. We had A153, which was an extension to the DTV system, the original DTV system for mobile, and it had some capabilities and some challenges, but we wanted ATSC 3.0 out of the box to be built in with mobile capabilities, and that means robustness. UHD video, hybrid services where we marry an over-air broadcast with an IP stream. Multi-view personalization, advanced advertising, the monetization we talked about. Accessibility, I'll have some slides on that later, and advanced emergency alerting to name a few. We started working on ATSC 3.0 in about 2010. That was the planning, followed by requirements, followed by development, and here we are, very nearly at a completed standard. ATSC 3.0 is a suite of standards. When we talked about ATSC 1, it was in the beginning essentially two documents, A52, A53 for audio and the rest in 53. Then we added PSIP and we added other stuff, a lot of other stuff along the way. But the beginning of ATSC 3.0, we knew it had to be flexible, and we knew it was complicated enough that we couldn't attempt to put it all in one thing. So there's one or more standards per layer, and those layers would be the physical layer, the management layer, and the applications layer, and then security is on top of that. Each standard moves through the process at its own pace. Final approval of the core of ATSC 3.0 is expected the end of this year, and we will get there. Now, by the end of this year, we may mean the 1st or 2nd or 3rd of January, but we're on track to do that. Of course, the FCC is considering rule changes to authorize the use of ATSC 3.0. Fred asked earlier if I was going to talk about that, and I'm really not, because ATSC doesn't lobby, doesn't really submit comments to, well, we submit informational comments to the commission, but we're not a petitioner. That's left to our member organizations. But of course, NAB, CTA, and other organizations have petitioned for essentially the approval of approval by the FCC to use the bootstrap to signal what's the ATSC 3.0 emission. And from what I hear, that is moving along nicely. ATSC 3.0 has been implemented in South Korea. They flipped the switch in May, and in a few months, they'll be doing the Winter Olympics in 4K nationwide. U.S. broadcasters, of course, are planning their transition scenarios. We've heard a lot about that. And synergy with the repack has been well covered. This graphic shows the progress of ATSC 3.0. As you can see, most of the documents are finalized. The rest, draft, candidate, proposed stages will be finished in the next few months. Now, this is ATSC 3.0. That implies ATSC 3.1. And we envision that, and we're talking about what that will include as well. So the panel discussion will begin in a minute, but Because Jay is unable to be here today, I wanted to give a few slides on his behalf specific to advanced emergency alerting. Jay has been the chair of the implementation team on advanced emergency alerting in ATSC for a long time, and so let me run through these slides on behalf of Jay. First of all, advanced emergency alerting is the next generation system and service to the public. It provides a more robust and reliable public warning and information system that is independent of the cellular network. We've seen dramatically and tragically in the last few weeks how broadcasters serve the public and how fragile the cellular network can be. Broadcasters are truly in a unique position to provide this public service. We want to leverage the broadcaster's role as a major public information provider, and broadcasters have built disaster-resilient facilities. They do this on a regular basis. They have a protocol for it. They have procedures for it, and it's important for any emergency-type operation for it to be something that's not only done when there's an emergency, but just as a regular course of business. This is what we do. We harden things. There are opportunities for broadcasters, of course, to enhance their station's brand and awareness, and also, and significantly, to serve the public interest, convenience, and necessity. The Advanced Emergency Alerting System provides a pipeline for extensive information beyond simple text, and we'll get to some examples in a minute. We're going to reach receivers of many types, fixed, portable, handheld, and there is a robust, very robust, as Fred had alluded to, wake-up signal that can turn receivers on that are in a sleep mode, and of course is very important if for overnight type situations and emergencies. The immersion standard enables receivers to prevent both a primary text message displayed as a banner or crawl, as you'd expect, and also audio announcements of primary alert messages. The alert messages are capable of targeting receivers in specific geographic locations, and that works for receivers who know where they are. And increasingly, receivers do know where they are. And going forward, that trend will certainly continue. AEA supports the optional delivery of multiple types of rich media, file-based and streaming over the air and internet that can be combined at the receiver, weather, radar, evacuation routes, and so forth. Here's some examples, rich media content. In this particular example, the map and the accompanying text could be delivered over the over-the-air broadcast and the weather satellite information on the other side of the screen delivered via either over-the-air or broadband and combined at the receiver. Here's graphics contents, and these graphics can be customized. It's not simple to do, but it's doable. Customize the graphics and the maps, like this one, to specific geographic areas. All these capabilities are built in. And the benefit to the user is pretty obvious. This is the advanced emergency alerting table, and sometimes it's fun to dive into the tables and get into the geeky stuff, but you can see here, this is really an eye chart, but the idea is to show who gets this with regard to the emergency messages, who gets it, where they are, when they should get it, alert notification language, the live media that's presented, and online media and other media sources that are presented. So there's a lot of flexibility in this system. Another part of ATSC 3.0 that isn't always talked about but is very, very important is accessibility. And accessibility is doubly important in times of an emergency. So there's a coupling between advanced emergency alerting and accessibility with regard to ATSC 3.0. We're bringing new service capabilities to the public, including robust audio and closed caption transmission, even when the picture fails. We can do that in a separate PLP, and that's a powerful feature. Improved audio intelligibility for the hearing impaired. New features for improved dialogue intelligibility for a dramatic program, let's say, a hearing impaired person, heck, myself, sometimes it's hard to make out the dialogue over the music and effects. We can give the user quite literally a knob to raise the dialogue level above the music and effects to make it more intelligible. ATSC 3.0 supports visual description, video description, closed caption, closed signing, dialogue intelligibility, and emergency crawls and audio tracks. So now back to the panel. I want to start with Fred, I think. Considering all of the various physical layer operating parameters, modulation coding, all the rest, what are the likely practical configurations for stations? Do you have a prediction as to what those two golden settings would be? I have this vision of Fred next to the transmitter flipping all these knobs. It's probably not far off, is it?
Oh, I'm going to get in trouble again. Can you hear me? I have to answer this with a story.
Okay.
And the story's kind of a short one, and it's the day before yesterday, and it was one of those times where we borrowed the boss's office, and we've been skirting around the issue of how many bits we're going to be able to get through this system. And I have just spent the day with Mike Simon, who is like the smartest guy on the planet, and I understand approximately 1.5% of the words he's speaking. So I have to keep going back and re-asking the question, and et cetera, et cetera. And at the end of the day, we come up with four possible mod cods that we're going to run. And I wish I had brought the sheet with you, but I really couldn't legally anyway. So give us a little time to get some testing done, and we're there. But that'll be the process, as we will run a bunch of tests, and we'll start to narrow it down. And the thing is, part of our testing, and we're trying to write the plan, so if anybody wants to help, this is a good one, is there are so many variables. There's FFTs, there's intervals, there's, you know, coding rates, et cetera, and some work and some don't, just given the nature of it. They're prohibited and allowed and all that. But to try and separate out what effect each one has, that's kind of our goal. So we know if I change the FFT, what happens to the receivability at the end of the day. And it's not all carrier to noise. There is one other thing that we're trying to get our head around, is that there's some magic thing that involves space, time, frequency, et cetera, because when it comes to bandwidth, it's not just about the band or payload. It's not just about the bandwidth. It's not just about the power. It's also about the time and the number of paths and all sorts of things along that line. So it's like this strange world, and we don't have a word for it yet. Did that make any sense at all?
I think so.
In other words, I'm not going to answer the question.
let me ask Christine, and we'll open up in just a minute for questions from the audience. What are broadcasters, your customers, saying about ATSC 3.0? How do you gauge their level of interest, and what are their major concerns, or, you know, do they have a timeline in mind?
Most of my customers, in major groups, the major networks, and even smaller stations, they're very interested in ATSC 3.0, but they're not committing to a timetable, time frame to do it. And no one's talking about their business plan, which is not unusual, because no one wants to tell the other party or group what they're doing or what they're going to do with it. I just want to point out a couple of things. Martin brought up a good point in his presentation that I failed to mention in mine earlier, that for those of you who are not repacking, Martin mentioned that there's a good likelihood that your equipment will work for 3.0. I'd really like to sell you a new antenna. However, there's a good likelihood that it will work if you have an antenna now. The only hesitation I have is if you're running that antenna currently near its maximum capacity, you might want to check with the manufacturer. Thing to remember is that the way these antennas are designed, slotted cylinders are designed, there is not an even distribution of power along all those slots. The antennas are designed for a certain amount of null fill and beam tilt. So with some designs, what you'll have is a lot of power concentrated in those first two or three layers near the base flange. In other designs, a good amount of power will be concentrated in the middle of the antenna on either side of the center of the antenna. So if you are running it close to its rated capacity, you might want to check with the manufacturer before you go to 3.0. The other thing to know is with respect to vertical component, now there I would have to sell you a new antenna because you cannot add vertical to an existing horizontal slotted cylinder. What happens is adding the vertical changes the loading characteristics and the VSWR of that antenna entirely, so you have to start from scratch in terms of the design. So you cannot add vertical to an existing antenna. Now, do you need to add vertical for ATSC 3.0 to work? Probably not. However, in a mobile world, will it work better with vertical? Probably will. So just keep those things in mind.
Can I throw one thing to them real quick? That I forgot to mention this in the SFNs, but one of the scary things is when you put six transmitters together, it turns out that that peak voltage problem, that rho wave thing, doesn't exactly add up the same way. All of a sudden, you need a lot more headroom in there, and it happens. It all fits in the system, but you know, I submitted my numbers, and Andy just laughed at me and said, "You idiot! You know that doesn't add that way," and it's true. Did you know that,
Martin? We talked a little bit about low V. Maybe we could expand a little bit on low V and mobile. Is it possible? And what are the? I suppose the drawbacks are noise and just antenna efficiency. More to it than that. If that's not enough.
I think that's most of it. So we've got a few stations either being repacked to low V, and there's a few already on low V. Fred mentioned this as well. Even just VHF high band is not as good as UHF. Building penetration, the antenna length on any received device that's portable and small, whether it be in your car, bus, in your pocket, in your basement of your house, something like a tablet, is not going to have a very efficient antenna. And the problem just gets worse the lower in frequency you go. And it's just mathematics and wavelengths, right? So wavelength and low V on channel 2 is, how long is it? It's huge, right? It's yards.
Six meters.
Yeah, 6 meters. So, yeah, thank you, Mr. Ham Radio. So it's useful to have him around. So the problem is you're not going to be able to intercept much of the wave when you receive, so the efficiency of the receive antenna is poor, which will make mobile reception on low V poor. The other problem Jerry just mentioned is the noise, natural noise, man-made noise, everything gets worse the lower in frequency you go. So the noise floor is a problem. So the only way it's going to work is at very low data rates, which is probably okay for some very small screen type reception of pictures or just audio would work fine. You know, QPSK type modulation or something a little bit stronger than that, but or less strong than that, but still robust might work. But I don't think it's the right solution. I honestly think UHF will be far better for mobile portable reception in the long run. And if anyone's on low V considering it, probably should try running some tests at least to see how it works, because even the antenna is going to be a problem. Christine would probably mention that you obviously know the antenna is going to be huge or low gain, because you can't have both, you know, so that's what, you know, on the transmit side. So you're not going to be able to do that. So you need a big low band transmitter and not a small one. You know, so it's an equation, right? You know, you've got antenna gain, you've got transmitter power, you've got some little bit of line loss to put in that formula. How much power are you going to be able to radiate anyway? So I think low band is going to be a real issue. If there are any in this region, I'm not even sure. So
okay.
Luckily, there's not that many.
One more round of questions, and then we'll go to the audience. Fred, it seemed a lot like a lot of the capabilities of ATSC 3.0, such as targeted ad insertion, such as dynamic and detailed user data, will require, and the lighthouse and the nightlight and all the rest of that, will require something that maybe broadcasters in the past haven't done a real good job at, and that is cooperating with one another. I think there's always been cooperation on the engineering side, you know, at the transmitter side, but is that the natural inclination of the front office to compete, even on technical grounds, going away?
You know, what I think is different this time. You know, nobody's asked that, and I've never talked about it, but people show up in Hunt Valley from the various groups to talk about ATSC3, and occasionally somebody will be sick, and I get to sit in on one of these meetings. And these are people way above my pay grade, and they're talking about, and they own hundreds of stations, and use your imagination, and I'm just kind of sitting there in awe in case they ask some engineering question I might be able to answer. The conversation is that I am aware of that goes on, that we talk about and all that. It's not like, you know, station A competing with station B across town and why should we cooperate and all that. What it is that the ownership has changed, and there are fairly large groups that cooperate together. And the one thing they all absolutely get is that if they don't do this, their business is going to die. And that's powerful motivation at the end of the day. And the other is that if you remember back to ATSC 1.0, you know, there was an awful lot of people who did not want to do that. It didn't provide a whole lot of benefit to broadcasters along the line. I am unaware of any broadcaster or any group or anybody who is opposed to ATSC 3.0 in any serious way at all. I mean, the equation this time around is completely different, at least from where I sit.
Christine, if we stop back to SFNs, which have been discussed a lot, can you give us an idea of what an SFN installation from the RF standpoint might look like? And are you envisioning that this is a combined shared site among several stations?
That's a good question. When we start doing presentations, we talk about ATSC 3.0 and single frequency networks filling in gaps and holes and providing more signal for high data rate services. The first thing people start thinking about is cost. And struggling with the cost of one single big stick, now you have the maintenance plus the installation costs and ongoing costs of 4, 5, 6 SFNs scattered around the market area. The concept that everyone seems to be talking about is that when these FSNs are built, that stations within the same market will combine their channels and co-locate at many of these same sites. That way, most likely those sites are similar to everyone in that market in terms of their difficulty in getting service to those locations, so it makes sense to everyone join together and join in those sites and combine their operations at the same time. In many of those locations, a lot of them will be on the fringes, so as to not extend your coverage area outside your contour. They will be directional in nature, focused back toward the big sticks, so to speak, and not to exceed their contour in the other direction. There'll be panel type antennas, low gain, as I think Fred or Martin mentioned earlier, low gain, heavy null fill, perhaps with the 5 or 10 kilowatt transmitter. It's hard to say right now what those levels will be, but further testing will prove this out. Most likely at about 300 feet because you don't want to go too high. But some of them may be located on mountain ridges and so forth, on existing structures at a shorter height. But the concept is to get the signal down, saturate the coverage area, and share those costs so that the upfront installation costs on a per station basis are much less.
Martin, what about the transmitter side? Any specific things to watch out for?
On an SFN like that, and, you know, the main thing is, as Christine pointed out, is to co-locate, share sites. On the transmitter side, the power levels can be, what Christine mentioned, 10 kilowatts. I found even internationally, Singapore is a good example of a country that has tons of SFN repeaters on channel. There's probably 160 of them, and Singapore is a very small country. Mm-hmm. And I asked one of the guys that's familiar with that, in fact, one of the guys that works for GemPro happens to live in Thailand and he goes to Singapore, and we have an office in Singapore, so I asked them about this. We didn't sell any of these transmitters, by the way, so there's no commercial here. These transmitters vary in power from like 2 watts to, you know, a couple of hundred watts. They're very low power. But what they're doing is they're doing SFN at a very small scale. Christine talked about a larger scale SFN around your main stick. They're doing it inside buildings and corners of buildings where they pick up the signal from one side of the building and radiate it to the other side of the building. This is a city with many tall buildings and people living in apartments, and they all want indoor reception to their handheld devices and mobile portable devices. So they're a very low power. So we have to have products that go from, you know, from the manufacturer point of view, we have the products go from 2 watts, 5 watts, up to tens of kilowatts. And SFNs can be any power level, as long as you do the math and make sure you're not interfering with, you know, adjacent channels and co-channels in the next market. You know, so you have to be careful, because you're talking about expanding the density of the signal near the boundary of the signal to get into those areas that are kind of shadowed and covered. But you want to be careful you're not. This is where you mentioned high null fill, but not too much power. So you have to be careful with the planning factors. Sometimes you need a consultant to do all the math for you. But transmitters aren't a problem. I mean, we already make them.
Well, Martin touches on two things that are kind of cool. One is there's two ways to look at single frequency networks. One's dense and one's sparse. And I only know the term.
Yeah.
So what I was talking about before was pretty much a sparse thing, which means very few sites, but they're fairly high power. I would argue that that's an absolutely lousy design, and I know that well, but we're going to learn that as time goes on. It's just a lot quicker to get it built. And the other is you can always add transmitters, and more importantly, the better design is the dense design where the transmitters are smaller but they're closer to you. Like I say, a kilowatt at the corner is worth a lot more than a megawatt in the mountain.
Right.
And then you get into distributed antenna systems to start to get into venues and transportation corridors and things like that. So once you let the genie out of the SFN bottle, you're going to start doing exactly what the cell phone guys did, is you put up a big tower at first to cover the whole town and it's crappy, and you start adding towers and you start breaking down the cells and you add more and more of them until you have ubiquitous coverage into every elevator and every building in the city.
Yeah. Okay, let's move to questions from the audience.
Jerry, one thing I want to say is keep in mind, too, that the SFNs are not simply to provide extra signal where your signal is poor. SFNs will be used, and your general managers will want to know this, SFNs will be used for target marketing for specific groups of people, which 3.0 allows you to do.
Do you guys understand that part? One of the things you can do, I'm sorry.
One of the things you can do, I mean, the problem with 3.0 is it can do like everything. One of the things you can do is you can geographically locate a bunch of people. So if you want to do a split spot and everybody gets a spot except this geographic area, you can flip the spot on a given transmitter at the end of the day. So, which is pretty cool.
Questions. There we go, sir. And over here.
Come off as a ham radio question for Fred.
I'm a loafer guy.
What about co-channel interference? We're running if you run a big transmitter, maybe an SFN around the outside of your coverage area, when you get a band opening, what happens to your SFN out on the fringe?
Oh, you mean like sporadic E?
No, I'm talking about an inversion. You know, you get your neighboring market is now flooding your DMA with their signal and vice versa.
Does that happen in UHF?
No.
All the time.
Not often.
Yeah, I'm giving you a little bit of a hard time, but remember, you're carpet bombing the area. So stuff that's going to come in from a distance, there's not much of an edge case where the signal level is low enough from the single frequency network in a usable area to have stuff come in from elsewhere. And think about it too, is, you know, our model is we got these big megawatts and that's an interference problem and adjacents and blah, blah, blah. But when you go to a single frequency network and you start to co-locate everything and you smooth it out, you can put people right next to each other. I mean, one of the things with the dielectric folks is I go, well, I need this combiner, and by the way, all the channels are co-channels, and I need six of them, and they go, well, that can be done. It's big, but it can be done, and that's what I think we'll see.
Yeah. We hear a lot about the transmission side and the hardware side of ATSC 3.0. We also hear a lot about advanced applications like ad insertion and so on. But what I don't hear much about is who's actually doing the work for those back-end systems that would make all these things possible. You know, we're all focused on RF and transmitters, and I don't know that I'm hearing much, in at least in my part of the business and where I'm active in. I don't hear much about the business models and the systems that are going to need to be developed to support that. I mean, broadcasters have very little experience with their own ad insertion systems, especially at the scale that we're talking about for ATSC 3.0.
You're talking about DAI, et cetera?
Pardon me?
You're talking about digital ad insertion kind of
that,
things?
That is one example of the kind of technologies, but all these other things that have to be developed in order to make these concepts work, I don't hear much about what's going on in that space.
I'll take a whack at that. There's a lot of work being done, and some of it's still in process. It's wrapping up. But there's a large infrastructure that's being built up with regard to ad insertion capabilities, watermarking. The pieces are falling into place for those technologies and others. Now, a lot of work needs to be done. NAB, with its pilot project, has done some very impressive work. But clearly, there will need to be an infrastructure inside and connected to the broadcast station in order to make it, you know, advanced services work. But that's coming. And there's certainly interest in it. There's interest in it on the part of broadcasters and vendors. Work related to the studio side is being done in SMPTE. We have liaison with NCTA and cable folks to make sure that what we broadcast in ATSC 3.0 will make its way to the cable systems. So those are in process. The major focus up till now has been, let's get the standard done so people can do implementations and try it out. But that work is coming forward. It's very important, but it's happening.
Good presentation on all of this. When we talk about single frequency network or distributed transmission system, which it was called before DTS, one thing we learned in this repack was that folks that gave up their channel and went for channel sharing were allowed to maintain a license, even though they're just a tertiary in a bitstream. So that's like zero lot line zoning, as far as I can tell. You can still own your property and live in an apartment building. To couple that with what we learned yesterday from Rody Schwartz in Europe, broadcasters are renting time or leasing time on transmitters. So suddenly, is that the architecture that we're headed towards? We'd be leasing time and have a bit portion of the bit stream with a license.
I'm going to be very tangential. When you talk about the single frequency networks and who owns them and all of that, you know what happens is it kind of turns into a utility. So I'm guessing that stations and station groups really do follow this model of they're paying for somebody to deliver the single frequency network to them from multiple channels, and it's like a monthly charge, and you know they've raised their own capital and they go and maintain it and they have their own BOC and their NOC, and there's probably entities out there that are in the cellular business that does that. And then the other part of it is, you know, that fuzzy concept that's floating around Sinclair, particularly of the broadcasting as a service. You know, there's a big element of that where you're allowed to buy bits back and forth, and I don't know where that ends. I don't know that Netflix can't come and say, I just want to go buy distribution, blah, blah, blah. Is that even close to your question?
The broadcasters are, it's like the Wild West. We like to have our homestead out on the prairie.
Yeah.
Now we're being told you got to move to town and join everybody else. And how do you maintain your identity? How do you maintain your brand and your business model without just relinquishing control?
Oh, you're at that.
And I see that the licensing as part of the bitstream maintains the identity and the business plan, because a big part of the value of a broadcaster is that license.
Yeah.
Not just the antenna, not just the towers. It's the license. So if you strip the license away from a broadcaster, now they might as well be doing a blog in the back bedroom for all intensive purposes.
No, I'm trying to remember who said that, and the way they phrased it was, if you don't have a license and a frequency, who are you? And I mean, because then anybody could be a TV station, I just go and stream it, right? Okay, this isn't going to work. Let's forget it. I don't know. That is a damn good question.
No, because the answer.
No one knows the answer. I do think the. I do, and I don't. You know, you're not your transmitter. You're your news department. The sad news is that if all you are is distribution, then that's kind of a different equation. You're headed to disintermediation anyway, and this is maybe a way to own that spectrum and that asset and still be in the distribution business. So this is probably a positive. But yeah, I mean, if you were to ask, this is nothing to do with anybody I work for or with, but you know, just we all think about where the business is going. I'm guessing that you're going to wind up with 2, 3, or 4 really strong, very news-oriented organizations, and that's kind of what television station morphs into at the end. You know, the next generation here, and then a bunch of its distribution, and it's your Wild West world, you know.
Over here.
On the radio side, we talk about the connected car. What ATSC delivered content is appropriate for the car?
You know, for the first tests, we've done some straw man of what we're going to do for programming, and the truth is I can't tell you much, and we're paying a lot of really smart people to figure this out, and a lot of that work isn't back yet. But there's been a constant theme that some of the marquee television stations wind up on an ATSC distribution platform, and a big part of ATSC distribution in the mobile first world and in Sinclair's view is that it does go to automobile manufacturers. So one of the other little factoids is that Sinclair not only owns an antenna company and used to own a transmitter company and a bunch of other stuff, but they own an awful lot of automobile distributorships out east. Now, why do they do that? Well, they want to put ATSC 3 in every vehicle out there. They want to go up against Sirius XM, and they want to do something with local radio and all of that. You know, and I'm sure that's going to happen, because when you think about it, the distribution platform just kicks the heck out of FM, and we won't even have to talk about AM. And it reaches into corners and places. I mean, I told you I'm an NPR addict. Trying to get NPR in my office in the Sinclair building, and I'm not that far from the windows, requires that I have something that looks like this Yagi taped up to my, you know, and everybody gives me a hard time about it. ATSC 3 would do considerably better with next generation broadcast, will do considerably better for radio also. And I see it as a hybrid platform, in particular in automobiles. And I'm stealing the gas buddy thing. That's a good idea.
As we move forward with implementations, a lot of business plans will be tried. Some will be wildly successful, others not so much, and others will fall by the way. I think we've all been in the business long enough to remember that in the very early days of HDTV, of DTV itself, there were no shortage of naysayers saying people wouldn't buy these big sets. Of course, then there were CRTs, that people of the public really didn't want HDTV, and a good SD signal was looked as nice as an HD signal. Well, we know how that turned out. So we've, at ATSC, we've been impressed with the level of interest from a broad range of companies, not just broadcasters, but broadcasters, consumer electronics manufacturers, equipment vendors, universities. And they're putting serious money behind this. And so we've recognized early on that it has to be consumer driven. There has to be a business aspect to it. And if the business case isn't there, in the end, it won't happen. So our design has been to make the, you know, give broadcasters the best tools that we can in order to give them the opportunity to do new business models. Other questions?
What research have you done comparing the experience in Europe with a DVB system? I'm seeing there's a lot of similarities, especially in modulation, but yeah, and signal frequency networks.
Yeah, that's a good question, because we've got some experience in that. We've shipped a lot of DVB-T2 transmitters. We've actually shipped thousands of mostly low power, but, you know, much lower power in this country. So there are some countries running single frequency networks in like localized regions, like you might hear around a city. That's quite common. I think the main issues have been planning the T2 network with SFN, being very careful about such things that are not used here yet, but guard interval, which allows you to have spacing between transmitters, but not overlap data that's transmitted, otherwise the receiver won't work. So you have to be very careful with things like guard interval, which is a setting in HSE3. It's very similar to DVB-T2. There are different settings, but it's a very similar concept. The modulations are extremely similar. There's a little bit better error correction in 3.0, so it has slightly better, you know, performance, but I would say they're very similar. So the experiences that we've learned is SFN with any OFDM type of modulation works very well. And I'm not just talking DVB-T2, we've done ISDVT in Brazil, Argentina. They're doing mobile in Brazil for many years now, actually, and it's quite successful. Everyone's receiving it, and it works well.
Another question, I guess, yeah, for Christine. When we get our new repack transmitters, got to get a new filter, do we have to buy the narrow filter for ATSC1 yet, or can we buy a wider filter and get away with it?
You just need the one filter, that's all. Yeah,
it'll the work same above. Filter.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Okay. In a given market, assuming an SFN environment, would you anticipate that there will be ATSC3 parameters that have to be adjusted cooperatively within the market for the system to work well in the market?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who makes those decisions and how do...
Go ahead.
I mean, the two standard jokes about this is Salt Lake City and New York are not the same place. By the way, I do know the answer to the guard interval. It's 4028, which gives you 92 microseconds, is it, or 60 miles spacing? I think I remember the numbers. That much I did figure out. That's at least what we're going to start with, which is pretty hefty. It means the transmitters can be put far apart. And the second joke is, when you ask about do we pay attention to Europe, the standard joke is ATSC3 is going to go over for the Atlantic or for the Olympics in Korea. 3.1 is going to come back. We pay a lot of attention to what happens at ETRI, and they are very... in fact, last time I think I saw Jerry was in Korea. They are very much pushing this forward, but from a receiver manufacturer, and they're looking at ultra-high definition, and of course we're looking at mobile first, so there are differences in how our business plans look.
Yeah. Got a question about antennas. In a former life, I worked at an FM that had a split ring and dipole antenna, so there was one antenna horizontal, one antenna vertical. Has anyone asked you to consider making a set of dipoles to add the V-pole to an existing slotted antenna? Or is that just so far out that it wouldn't work at all?
You can do that, but most likely the vertical is going to be... there's two things wrong with that. One, you're not going to have the proper phasing between horizontal and vertical. So that means that because you don't have 90 degree phasing, you're not going to have circular polarization or elliptical, you're going to have linear. And that means at certain locations you might have a cancellation that takes place between the signals based upon reflections. But the other thing is, if you add vertical, a separate vertical antenna, it's most likely going to be a fewer number of bays to make it work. That's going to take a lot more power than it would be if you include a vertical on the main antenna. So while you may save on the antenna side, you may lose on performance in the field, and it may also be more costly to do it from the transmitter.
Back to the emergency system. You're talking about single frequency networks, and if I understand it right, you're talking a lot of smaller sites or additional sites First thing that comes to mind is robustness and maintaining power during an emergency or something really nasty. Does anybody have a, how many generators are you going to have in the field to maintain that power, and are you going to be able to get them up out of harm's way in case of flooding and stuff like that?
There's a really good answer to that, is that when you start with a topology where you have a main stick, a boomer, okay, you're going to harden that to beat all things. So if everything else to get smashed into the ground, I still got 1,000,000 watts on a mountain. You can walk outside with your device and put it up and find a place to pick it up. If I'm going with the sparse scenario as the first build out, I've only got 4 other sites to harden. I'll harden them. Okay. Really don't care about the rest of it in an emergency, because if it's hard to pick up and you have to change your position in order to make the receiver work, that's probably tolerable. Does that make sense?
I think the emergency signal is pick-upable in very high noise. I think somebody mentioned it earlier.
That's the bootstrap that triggers the warning. You see, when you get into emergency alerting, I could spend 6 days on this. There's a huge difference between alerting and informing. Okay. And alerting is actually pretty simple, and all that says is there's a tornado, it's headed your way, take cover. Okay, you know, the radio is supposed to turn on and stuff like that. So part of what we're hoping ATSC3 does with the advanced emergency alerting is that we'll make devices that do in fact wake themselves up, know where they're located, and only wake themselves up at the right time. And the default when you unpack your TV is your TV will turn on. One of the problems with the mobile devices is that in order to save battery life, you have to put them to sleep for a while. So they only wake up when they're going to receive something. And in ATSC3, it's non-deterministic when that bootstrap symbol is going to change. It triggers it. So there's a group called the I-Team. It's the implementation team inside ATSC3. Did I get this wrong? They're busy working on trying to figure out how to do that. And again, you look at the holistic environment. The wireless emergency activation thing works pretty good. I don't know if you've ever been in, I was in a light rail the other day, and there an amber alert went off, and the entire train lit up, you know, with every mobile device with this amber alert simultaneously on it kind of thing, and you go, that's pretty damn good. To use WIA along with ATSC3 actually makes some certain sense, but all that needs to be developed over time, and there are so many tricks that can be done in order to do the battery savings, et cetera, to make the emergency triggering part work.
Other questions? Right over here.
Yeah. A question, just a practical scenario to kind of help me understand this. Currently, I live here in Madison, and am with an outdoor antenna, am able to sometimes receive Milwaukee stations. Now, with ATSC 3.0, if I'm understanding this correctly, now I would be out of the SFN of any Milwaukee station, obviously, that wouldn't be a consideration. But if the station is doing a lot of data payload, well, then I maybe not be able to receive it? Or is the coverage going to remain the same regardless of?
Yeah, I can answer that. The payload and the way the settings are for the modulation programs will make a big difference to how far away physically you can receive that. So where you have very high data rates, high payloads, and you're using, you know, a huge big constellation and you know, minimum of error corrections you can get the payload through, basically you need a higher signal to noise ratio environment to be able to decode that signal. You won't actually pick it up at that distance. You'd have to do the math. So the only signals you would get is if, for instance, that same station transmits a standard definition program, maybe the same program, but at a different data rate, this SD quality, you know, lower quality, but would be running on, you know, 16 QAM, some better, you know, code rates that are more suitable for robustness, more scattered pilots, whatever it takes, that receiver would now work at a much greater distance. And the distances can be significantly different depending on how you set up the parameters. I think there's some testing needed to be done and some, you know, and I think Fred pointed out there's a little bit more work to be done on some typical settings and setups that might work best. A lot of work to be done. A lot of work to be done, but I think we're gradually learning this.
Well, one of our test points is actually over the horizon. That's how robust you can make it.
With the right settings.
With the right setting.
Yeah.
Other questions? Okay. Well, let me finish up with one more round of questions to the panel. And if anybody thinks of anything in the meantime, throw your hand up. I guess this is for Christine and Martin both. John Madden has been quoted more than once as saying that with regard to professional sports, it doesn't matter what the question is. The answer is money. So for ETSC 3.0, is the answer power?
First.
Well, you heard me say it.
It's a trick question.
Well, I think we've talked about that already. It's going to be what the payload is that you're trying to deliver. If it's a high data rate service, yes. If it's something other than that, perhaps not. So, and different groups and different stations may have different business plans. So your needs are all going to vary depending upon what those business plans are.
Yeah, I think I can. If you wanted to transmit what you are today, and most people have a bigger vision of what they will use this for, you could actually turn the power down and get exactly the same viewers, the same number of people could receive it, so you could turn the power down. But I think most people who want to crank up power as much as they're allowed to, add more services, add ultra-high definition, add other features that are going to become available, already available in the system, and make maximum use and maximize their income from, you know, you could be selling paid services, video on demand, all sorts of things will come with this.
And bigger transmitters
and
are
bigger
good,
transmitters
right?
are better.
Okay, and finally for Fred. In a past life in a galaxy far away long ago, you had experience in rolling out a mobile DTV service. What did you learn? What mistakes can we avoid this time around?
There's 50 answers to that. So if you ask any of us old media flowers, we'll tell you different things. I will tell you a couple of things. I will tell you it was not unsuccessful for Qualcomm because of who Qualcomm is. Qualcomm is an intellectual property company. When I signed it on, I had signed a contract that said that I would be sold into slavery as soon as possible. They were going to spin this out, and don't expect to be a Qualcomm employee forever. I did not buy a house in San Diego because of that. Did not move there. No, besides that, you can buy a lot of plane tickets for a house in San Diego. And in the end, they had spent $3 billion on it. $1 billion for the spectrum, $1 billion for the transmitters and the antennas and all that, and $1 billion to do the engineering, the NRE in order to develop it. When they were done, they sold the spectrum for $3 billion and walked away with several thousand patents, which is what they were all about. And I think it's fair to say that there's an awful lot of that IPR sitting inside APSC 3 today. I mean, when I didn't pay a whole lot of attention to this for a while, but when I first started reading about ATSC 3, I was going, this is media flow. The other reason they failed is this. They played two cards at once. They were doing LTE and 5G development, which is the alternative, which is actually more profitable in their end of the business than media flow would have been. So as the wireless network came up faster, the whole idea of having a broadcast platform started to become less and less important. And then finally, the one I really love is that the content was crap. They did not understand that people would not watch reruns of Lost in Space.
I would.
So the demand curve. had the receiver bundled or something along the way. So yeah.
Okay, thank you. Well, and as a side, I can't help but tell the story. Since you brought up Lost in Space, when my youngest daughter was quite young, one day we used to watch Lost in Space. She thought it was fun, and for some reason, she was six at the time. So anyway, we go to the local Ace Hardware store, and I was searching for dryer stuff, and she finds this corrugated aluminum dryer vent stuff. She puts one on one, goes, warning, danger. I was so proud of her.
Danger,
And so with that, we'll wrap up the panel. Thank you, Fred, Christine, and Martin. Thanks, everybody, for attending. Leonard, we'll turn it over to you.
Thanks, everybody.